सप्ताह तक ऑनलाइन अवेलेबल है.
Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today is 22nd of January. We will continue listen to Tenjin Tosin's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Devi. And please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering. Welcome and thank you for joining the program today. We've been basically talking about what makes life meaningful, and in particular, what will help us when we finally have to face death and look back on what we've done with our lives. This is a vital part of Buddhism, because if we never think about death and what it actually means for our life, we will always only be focused on the transient and basically meaningless pursuits that we think will bring us satisfaction in this life. Let's take, for example, the lust for good reputation. This can range from wanting to be mega famous to looking for recognition in our workplace. Most of us want to be liked and even held in high esteem, at least among the people who know us, and get upset if someone says something derogatory about us. However, what good will a nice reputation do for us when we're lying on our deathbed and facing leaving everything behind forever? We cannot take it into our next life, and even if it endures after we are gone, we will get no benefit from it at all. In fact, if we worry about what people are going to say at our funeral as we're dying, we will be setting up a mental state of anguish for the death process, and that will not be so good for our next rebirth. The other thing about fame or reputation is that it's so very fickle. One moment you can be the toast of the town, and the next completely forgotten, or totally vilified. Soon after I arrived in New Zealand, I joined Auckland University's theatre workshop and acted in a number of their plays. One of the first was Romeo and Juliet, in which I played the dashing, quick-witted and mocking Mercutio, one of my favourite theatre characters, I must admit. I had great fun with the part and played to the audience who seemed to love it. People would recognize me in the street, and I heard them whisper, "Mercutio, Mercutio," as I passed. But a year, even 6 months later, no one was interested anymore. And now, I doubt anyone remembers. This is the nature of reputation. It lasts for such a short time, and if you want it to continue, you have to really work at it. Some years after the theatre workshop, Romeo and Juliet, I directed the same play at what was then the New Independent Theatre in Upper Queen Street in Auckland. The play was a total flop and got bad reviews in the Herald and even in the Listener. But now, who remembers? Perhaps the odd, overly ardent thespian, but the production and its smelly reviews have become less than the merest wisp in the annals of Auckland's theatrical history. In the theatre, there's a saying, "You are only as good as your last play." So you can imagine the energy that goes into trying to keep up a name for yourself. And all for what? At the end of life, it's all wasted effort. It has not benefited you or anybody else in the slightest. A few years after your death, when someone mentions your name, people will say, "Who? Oh, yes, wasn't he or she that actor or singer or comedian or racing driver or whatever? I think I do remember him or her." And then they go on to recall something embarrassing about you or what you did. But this is true of anything that we make a focal point for this life. Money, relationships, possessions, health. None of them are stable, no matter how hard we work to make them so. They're all created with inbuilt transience and obsolescence. And if they do last until we die, we have to forsake them as we give up this body. And then, what meaning have we given to our life? Nothing that we can take with us on the most difficult journey we could face. So that is why Shantideva follows the Buddhist tradition of contemplating death as much as he does. For if we think we have a long life ahead of us, we will be careless with our time and actions. Whereas, if we recognize that death is an unshakable rider on our shoulder, ever ready to jump off and lead us away, we will be much more careful of what we do with the rest of the time we have. Think about it. Say you have a bit of a tummy ache and go to see the doctor. He does some tests, and then today calls you to his clinic and says, "The tests show that unfortunately it's not just a virus. You have cancer and only have a month to live. I'm very sorry." How would you spend your next 30 days? Eating, drinking, and making merry? That would be quite foolish. Wouldn't you try to put everything in your life in order and do what you can to have a peaceful death? Wouldn't the next 30 days take on a meaning and color much more significant than all the days up to now? I think that for me they would, and I try to do everything I can to make those last days meaningful, both for this and my coming life. Mahayana Buddhism says that the best way to make your life meaningful is to develop bodhicitta, the mind that wishes to attain enlightenment, to help temporarily and ultimately all beings everywhere, not just humans, but insects, animals, reptiles, fish, birds, and all the other types of beings, some of whom we know nothing about, on this and other planets. This is a very rare and precious intention, for who would actually think of taking on such a huge task? Mostly we can't satisfy just ourselves, never mind even thinking of satisfying others, especially those in much worse circumstances than we're in. However, in Buddhism, such an intention is supreme, because its focus is the well-being of infinite number of beings, and because it is so far-ranging in its benevolence, it brings great positive potential or merit. The text we're going through in these programs, Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, is a kind of working manual on how to develop bodhicitta and strengthen it until it's so powerful that it becomes the driving force now and in all our lives until enlightenment. This being so, let's now take a moment to examine our motivation for this program and to ensure that it is bodhicitta. Let's participate in this program today so that it will become a cause for us to reach enlightenment for the sole purpose of helping all others to be free of their suffering and to bring them both ultimate and temporary happiness. Please try to set such a motivation, but if you really can't, at least motivate that the program will be a cause for you to become an arhat, liberated from all suffering and its causes. Thank you. Now, in the verses of Shantideva's text that we went through last week, on realizing that death might be close and that he's not in good shape, the author invoked various deities that stand for the enlightened qualities of all the Buddhas. For instance, you might remember he called on Avalokiteshvara, the embodiment of the compassion of the Buddhas, Manjugosha, the embodiment of the wisdom of the Buddhas, and Vajrapani, the deity representing the power of all the Buddhas. As I said, this was not an invocation for the deities to create some magic that would release him from misery. It was an appeal to the enlightened qualities of his own mind to manifest, for it is through the realization of our positive potential that the negative tendencies on our mind are weakened and eventually eradicated. Nobody can wave a magic wand to ensure all our troubles will be over. But as Shantideva says in the next verses, we have to follow and practice the advice of the teacher, just as a patient follows the advice of a doctor. Previously I transgressed your advice, but now upon seeing this great fear, I go to you for refuge. By doing so, may this fear be swiftly cleared away. If I need to comply with a doctor's advice when frightened by a common illness, then how much more so when perpetually diseased by the manifold evils of desire and so forth? And if all people dwelling on this earth can be overcome by just one of these, and if no other medicine to cure them is to be found elsewhere in the universe, then the intention not to act in accordance with the advice of the all-knowing physicians that can uproot every misery is extremely bewildered and worthy of scorn. As you probably know, the metaphor of the patient, doctor, and medicine is common in the Buddhist description of a disciple's relationship to the Buddha and Dharma. In the analogy, we are the patients because we have the sickness of deluded minds, while the Buddha is the doctor who prescribes the medicine for the sickness. The Dharma is, of course, that medicine. Shantideva embellishes the analogy as he says that if he is fearful enough of an ordinary illness to want to take a doctor's advice, he should be much more scared of the diseases of desire and the other afflictions which lead not just to death, but to endless sufferings for eons in hellish situations. Pema Chodron points out in her commentary on this verse that our main disease is self-absorption and ignorance. These are at the root of all our afflictions. So it's not as if we need to catch all the afflictions to land up in hell. Just one overriding emotion, the manifestation of self-absorption and ignorance, will do it. I recently heard of a man who was killed by a jealous husband who thought the man was having an affair with his wife. The husband was duly arrested and will no doubt spend much of the rest of his life in jail. But even worse, he now has the karma of killing on his mind stream, and if he doesn't purify it, that karma could land him up in a dreadful future life experience much worse than that in a New Zealand jail. Both men were in their 20s, so both lives have been thoroughly destroyed by the intensity of the affliction jealousy. The saddest thing about this, though, is that none of us can say we are immune. When we get vitriolic, for instance, about the people involved in situations like the deaths of Chris and Crew, the sons of Max Sinner Kim and Chris Kahui, we assume that we would never act as that father and mother did. But that assumption ignores our underlying conditioning. Put us in the same lives as Max Sinner King and Chris Kahui, and can we really state without doubt that we would have acted differently? In what situation will I be so overtaken by afflictive emotion that I will commit horrendous acts against others? I don't know. But I do know that until I'm well along the path to enlightenment, in some situations I could be so overwhelmed that I will do terrible things to others to save myself, even though I know something about the Buddhist teachings. Therefore, I find it difficult to make judgments in cases like that of the Kahui twins. This failure in the face of powerful affliction, Shantideva admits for all of us with the lines, "And if all people dwelling on this earth can be overcome by just one of these." Just one affliction, if strong enough, can cause our downfall, and its object doesn't have to be anything important. Take road rage, for instance. People get angry enough to attack and really harm others over the smallest perceived slight on the roads, just overtaking too close, or cutting in front, for instance, something that by itself calls for nothing more than a bit of pressure to the brakes. But the mere idea that he could be involved in what the Auckland traffic controllers call an incident can force an irritable driver to take a hammer or a tire iron to an offending driver in his car. Shantideva says that only the advice and teachings of the Buddhas, those he calls the all-knowing physicians, can cure us of the delusions that afflict us like a particularly tenacious disease. So if we only have this one panacea, the Buddha's teachings, for all our ongoing of suffering, how extremely bewildered and worthy of scorn will we be if we now do not make the best use of it? Of course, it's not easy to put the Buddha's teachings into practice. We are easily distracted by the attractions around us and equally easily upset when our desires are not met. Then we automatically, it seems, give in to the afflictions. Can you easily remain calm and compassionate when someone vigorously attacks you? Even just a small insult can make strong anger arise, so it takes a lot of practice to transform the mind. But if we're not prepared to do the practice, we can look forward to many lifetimes of suffering ahead. If we do take on a regular practice, we can change that suffering to happiness, even if the work is hard and slow. His Holiness the Dalai Lama takes a slightly different tack with these verses. He talks about the three ways of making offerings to the Buddhas to show our appreciation of their kindness to us. We can offer material things, like flowers, food, etc. We can offer services, like tending for monasteries, stupas, statues, and so on. And we can offer our practice of the teachings. Of these, the best is the offering of practice, for this directly eliminates suffering and fosters happiness in ourselves and others. Therefore, His Holiness says, we must practice what we learn, and not only will that repay the Buddha's kindness, but it will also free us from suffering. Shantideva then goes on about the danger we face if we do not practice what the Buddha taught. If I need to be careful near a small, ordinary precipice, he says, then how much more so near the one of long duration that drops for 1,000 miles? It is inappropriate to enjoy myself thinking that today alone I shall not die, for inevitably the time will come when I shall become nothing. Who can grant me fearlessness? How can I be surely freed from this? If I shall inevitably become nothing, how can I relax and enjoy myself? The precipice of long duration indicates both the danger that we might fall into the lower realms from where it is very difficult to escape, and what Pema Chodron calls the samsaric mindset of continually seeking comfort and trying to avoid pain. All the worldly activities are geared to finding pleasure, convenience, and comfort, and running from anything that causes discomfort. Even those situations that we know are good for us, like a visit to the dentist, but which involve some relatively minor discomfort, become like torture chambers for our minds. And no matter how many lives we have used up in trying to find comfort and avoid its opposite, we still haven't found any long-term happiness. Nor has any other being among the uncountable trillions. In fact, as long as we go on making our goal this chase after comfort and dodging discomfort, we will at the best of times only be teetering on the edge of a ridge with a very long drop to a very rocky landing place on either side. As Pema Chodron says, for endless lifetimes we've been falling into this trap of seeking pleasure and avoiding pain. Now let's get smart and strive not to do so anymore. How can we relax, she and Shantideva ask, with the negative tendencies in our minds? Death will inevitably come, and if we've not reviewed our psychology, brought everything to light, and dealt with it appropriately, we won't be able to relax and let go at the time of death. If we've looked honestly at the past, we can go with a clear conscience and a happy mind. What remains with me now from the terminated experiences of the past, writes Shantideva. But through my great attachment to them, I've been going against my spiritual master's advice. It's easy when we first hear the Buddha's teachings to become very inspired and enthusiastic and to vow that we will work diligently until enlightenment. The trouble is, we don't know how long that means. Usually we grasp at a limited time span. Even if the duration of our effort is not specified, we think, I will work hard and soon I will be enlightened. In the Tibetan tradition, practitioners sometimes do 3-year retreats, and hearing this, Westerners think that if they can do such a retreat, they will come out enlightened. His Holiness the Dalai Lama comments on this with these words, I would like to point out that to set out on a retreat for 3 years full of hope and expectations, thinking that without the slightest difficulty you will come out of it fully enlightened, can turn into a disaster, unless you undertake it with the most serious intentions. If you overestimate your expectations and have too much self-confidence, you will be headed for dissatisfaction and disillusionment. When you think of what the Buddha said, that perfect enlightenment is the result of spiritual purification and an accumulation of virtues and wisdom for eons and eons, it is certain that courage and perseverance will arise to accompany you on the path. The problem is not that we are not keen to do the work. The problem is that we underestimate what we have to do, the length of time it will take us, and the influence of our habitual tendencies, especially the tendency to cling to what is elusive and impermanent. What can we say of the incidents of the past? We can only say that they're a memory, nothing else. But we cling to them, as Pema Chodron says, either as our nostalgia for the good times or our fear of the bad times. And because of that, when our spiritual advisor, the one who might have put us into a 3-year retreat in the first place, gives us an instruction outside our emotional framework, our mind rebels and retreats to what it is used to. We know in our heads that the advice of the spiritual teacher is the best thing to follow, but our habits and tendencies sabotage that advice and we revert to what we may have over lifetimes convinced ourselves is in our best interest. But it's not. It is in our worst interest, and we just refuse to learn the lesson. So we might go into a 3-year retreat full of confidence and enthusiasm, but come out early, disillusioned and miserable. Like the Tibetan merchant inspired by the famous yogi Milarepa. Milarepa went through extraordinary practices later in life to purify a mountain of negative karma he had created earlier on. Then he went into the Himalayas and meditated strenuously for years, often without much in the way of physical support like food, clothing, and so on. Eventually, he came out enlightened. When this rich Tibetan merchant heard of Milarepa's story, he decided that he too was going into the mountains to stay until he was enlightened. So, against the advice of all his friends and relatives, he gave away all his goods and went off to find himself a cave in the snow. 3 weeks later, he was back down again, complaining that all Milarepa had done for him was make him poor. Sit in a cave and start looking at your mind without any previous training or advice, and you will soon be itching to get back to a comfortable bed, warmth, a cup of coffee, a gaggle of friends, and the latest movie. We must first examine our tendencies and understand where they lead us and how they afflict us. Only when we acknowledge them and, as Pema Chodron says, start to question the intelligence of continuing to harm ourselves for the sake of such transience, that we will make any progress. We have to know what we're doing and really understand its harm before we will be able to undertake the very extensive and lengthy work to change. Having departed from this life and from all my friends and relatives, if all alone I must go elsewhere, what is the use of making friends and enemies? How can I be surely freed from unwholesomeness, the source of misery? Continually day and night, that should I only consider this. Here, Shantideva talks about the meaninglessness of slotting people into the categories of friend and enemy. In the end, as we leave this life, all those categories empty out. No longer will the people we have called friend have any meaning for us, nor will those we've regarded as our enemies. We will have to go on alone, leaving behind both friend and enemy. But wherever we go, we will still have the tendency to make friends with some and enemies of others, a tendency that will continue to cause us many problems. For even during life, these categories are fickle and unhelpful. Although we expect our friends and relatives to be our support, often it is someone closest to us that hurts us the most. And sometimes those people we dismiss sneeringly can really teach us a life lesson. Think about the friends you had when you were much younger. Are they still your friends? I bet if any are, it will only be one or two at the most. Similarly, those people that you disliked when you were much younger, how many of them do you still dislike or even know? Would you recognize them if you walked past them in the street today? Thus it is with friends and enemies. Even though they might loom huge in our life at one time, at another time they mean so little to us. All they really do is create unhelpful tendencies on our minds that we have to face at some future date, and that will inevitably bring us pain. But this is not only true of how we view people, but also of how we see things in our life. Some things appear friendly, others seem harmful, but it all comes down to how the mind views things. The Australian monk Ajahn Brahm tells the story of one of his fellow monks speaking to some prisoners in a jail. The prisoners asked the monk what it is like in a Buddhist monastery in the West. "We get up so early in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, And then we have to go to this cold hall to sit for hours, cross-legged, meditating and doing some chanting, said Ajahn Brahm. And then only afterwards, maybe at 6:30, we might get a cup of tea. And then you have to work for 3 or 4 hours, hard work, before you can get some lunch. And that lunch is just what you're given. You're given no choice, and it's all eaten in one bowl, all mixed together, so it's not very delicious at all. And in the afternoon, it's usually more work. And then you can't watch television. There's no television or radio, and you can't follow sport. You can't play sports. You can't play music or listen to music. There's no movies to watch, and there's nothing in the evening. You can't even eat in the evening, except just to go to the main hall to sit in more meditation, cross-legged on the hard floor for hours. And when you do go back to your hut to sleep, it's on the floor in the cold. When this monk told the prisoners that, they were very shocked, said Ajahn Brahm. And this is when one of the prisoners forgot where they were and said, "That's disgusting. That's terrible. It's awful. Why don't you monks come and live in here with us in the jail?" Which was crazy. They forgot where they were. But the important part of that story, says Ajahn Brahm, was the reason why my monks and other people who visit the monastery like to stay there. And it's because they're content. They don't look upon the monastery as a prison, simply because it's where they want to be. Whereas prisoners in a jail, because they don't want to be there, therefore it's a prison. We suffer because of what Shantideva calls our unwholesome states of mind, those self-centered states of mind that always look for comfort and a run away from discomfort. So motivated, we create actions that will inevitably lead to suffering in the future. Shantideva says from now on, he's going to free himself from those mindsets. Whatever has been done by me through ignorance and unknowing, be it the breaking of a vow or a deed by nature wrong, I humbly confess it all in the presence of the protectors, with folded hands prostrating myself again and again, my mind terrified by the misery to come. I beseech all the guides of the world to please accept my evils and wrongs. Since these are not good, in future I shall do them no more. In verse 63, when he talks about a deed by nature wrong, it refers to one of the 10 non-virtuous actions: killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, gossip, slander, harsh words, covetousness, harmful thoughts to others, and wrong views. As Pema Chodron says, it's very difficult to resist the seduction of our habits, even though we know they bring unsatisfactory results. We have to acknowledge where we get hooked and develop what she calls heartbreak with samsara, a nausea to act on unwise impulses again and again. She says by using the four opponent powers, regret, taking refuge, doing a counteraction to and promising not to do the negative action again, against all our previous negative actions, as Shantideva does, we place emphasis on pragmatic intelligence, face the facts compassionately, and promote our best interests. Being mindful of upcoming suffering gives us the motivation to resist the undertow of harmful urges. In her own words, "So, in the presence of the guides and guardians of the world, Shantideva holds nothing back. Relying on the inspiration of the awakened mind, he presents an unabridged version of his previous deeds and says, 'Take me as I am.' Having fully acknowledged past and present actions, he wholeheartedly aspires never again to be deceived by the false promise of addictions and rote responses. By cleaning the slate, he creates the opportunity for his basic sanitude to emerge." Now we've come to the end of the chapter on confession and time is up. As I mentioned last week, I will be in Australia for at least the next month, so our current program will go into recess until I return. I pray all goes well with you until then. Please dedicate any positive potential from this program to gaining bodhicitta. Thank you and goodbye.